You're mad because I kind of hung up on your precious king.
Yeah, well, you think I'm going to like it for you coming out here every single week and trying to interrupt our program and do it.
We can do whatever we want to do.
You may just find out, Miss Missy, that you can't do everything that you want to.
From Television City in Hollywood,
this podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Discretionary viewer participation is advised for the following professional wrestling exhibition.
Greetings from Allentown is taped in front of a live studio audience.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 144 of Greetings from Allentown. I am your host, Peter Winson. And today, as American Thanksgiving is today as this show drops, I thought to myself, well, what do I have to give thanks for from a professional wrestling perspective? And after thinking about it for about 40 seconds, I thought, oh yeah, Memphis Wrestling, and a proper Memphis Wrestling show from the 80s with Lance Russell and Dave Brown on commentary. So consider this my Thanksgiving. And I guess the turkey in this case would be Eddie Gilbert in the middle, I guess more towards the end of his war with Jerry Lawler. Maybe more at the end of the battle, since that war between Eddie and Jerry Lawler was not about to end. Hell, even when Eddie Gilbert passes away in 1995, Doug Gilbert picks it up and, well, some shit happened late in the 90s with those guys. But anyway, let me get in my plugs real quick. You can email the show, greetingsfromallentown@gmail.com, facebook.com/greetingsfromallentown. Give me a follow on Twitter at GF Allentown Pod. That is at GF Allentown Pod. And I apologize, for I have not been tweeting out those superstars intros where we get the overview of what's going on in the city or the arena or the speech by the guy who is like the arena manager. I need to get back to doing those because I kind of ran out of them on YouTube. So maybe I just need to surf through it once again. But yes, do give me a follow on there since I post there a hell of a lot more than I would on Facebook. By the way, I think it's a little insane that I went away for a week and I didn't have my computer with me, but yet I still have decided to do more podcasting while traveling. When I was down there, I took notes for future shows, which I think is smart because I don't have as much time on the weekends to actually watch wrestling. I don't know. Maybe I just need to carve out the time. But the fact that I just didn't take a week off and instead did a two-part 1992 Royal Rumble episode. Rest assured, I am committed to the cause of wrestling podcasting, just sitting here alone in my basement with the cat sitting next to me as the studio audience. Yeah, this cat's very good. Just sits on the arm of the chair and is quiet, just has her head down. It's quite nice. And podcasting over the last 2.5 years has been somewhat therapeutic, but right now I'm thinking of it from the perspective of, if I'm talking and I'm podcasting, that means I'm not eating. Because I made the cardinal mistake for a ring veteran of coming back from a vacation and weighing myself the next day, which was beyond idiotic. Because when I was in Florida, I had multiple beers per day. Because nothing counts from a calorie perspective. And I'm just not thinking about what I'm eating. Oh, would you like to have the Italian beef egg rolls that they had on special at that sports bar? Sure, why the hell not? Especially since we had 10 wings as an appetizer right beforehand. That's got to be healthy as well. Oh, who wants a greasy chicken sandwich? Well, that might be better than some other things, but sure, I'll, you know, eat that and get heartburn or whatever the hell happened to me. Or I had to go grab some Tums at the Walgreens nearby during the week. Donuts, breakfast sandwiches on a salt bagel. Yeah, maybe I need to give a little bit more thought to what I'm eating. So I've gone on a diet of at least trying to be cognizant of what I'm eating. I'm not doing, you know, any of the diets from a book, any of the newfangled fad ones. I'm just trying to recognize, you know, not to put a bunch of shit into my body. Not to keep swearing during this. I mean, that's two S-bombs so far. But try not to eat multiple bagels in one sitting. That's not really going to fly. Don't eat, like, an entire pizza in one sitting. And in fact, try to limit your pizza consumption to, I don't know, once every 3 weeks. One thing that's probably going to help in that regard is I work in a small office now. There's no cafeteria where they're going to have pizza there every single day. Because the last two jobs that I worked at, you know, very, very relatively easy access to pizza, I have to admit. So try, and also, there's a candy dish out because there's Halloween, and everybody else in the office is trying to unload their candy. And I've now prohibited myself from that, which is fairly easy because it's mostly Butterfingers, and while it's probably okay, I haven't eaten a lot of Butterfingers in my life. The 100 grand bars, those are harder to steer myself away from. Just trying to put my head down and focus on what I'm doing at work because I'm still learning the system and, you know, it's going to be a bit of a long process in a project. So the last thing I need is to be closer to the 300-pound mark than the 200-pound mark. I have no illusions that I could ever get down to 200 even. I mean, I'm 6 feet half an inch, and that's probably where I should be. But the lowest that I've weighed in the last 15 years, I want to say, is about 221 pounds. And that was right after the Bruins won the Stanley Cup in 2011. And how did that happen? I was going to a lot of hockey games in the spring, which didn't ordinarily happen. And when I would come home, I wouldn't eat, I wouldn't drink at these games, and then I wouldn't come home and have two beers or two bourbons or, God forbid, two beers and two bourbons, maybe a scotch. Nah, probably not that, but not putting all that stuff into my body. So I'm hoping that just by having, you know, limiting my alcohol intake per week, that I could get back to, I'm not going to say I'm going to weigh 192 like I weighed in 2004 when I gave up alcohol for Lent in a very strange move since I was in Las Vegas and clearly alcohol was pretty much all that I had. It's just that, you know, trying to be a little bit more thoughtful rather than adhering to I have to do this or counting calories. Just, you know, start with that step and if it doesn't work, well, then I can move on to other things. I mean, the whole thing's not going to make me happy at the end of the day. But I'll tell you what will is Memphis Wrestling. Like I said, this is a proper Lance and Dave show. I always hate when I watch like a random episode of Memphis and Dave is on there by himself. He's like, oh yeah, Lance has this week off. I'm like, oh shit, why did I pick this episode? Like, why did I have to pick the one where Lance isn't there or the one where Dave isn't there? Although, granted, Lance is the more important piece of the two. Here in April of 88, it's maybe not the hottest time in the history of Memphis wrestling, but it's certainly interesting because your main guy, Jerry Lawler, he's on the title track for the AWA title. Memphis and the AWA always had a very close relationship, probably due in part to the fact that, you know, they're not part of the NWA and the WWF. I mean, forget about that. But it is weird because Memphis and the AWA, like those two television shows, have absolutely nothing in common with each other. AWA doesn't run any angles on their TV, and Memphis is just, you know, their cup is running over with it. So Lawler, he's on track to face Henning for the AWA title in May, and he finally does prevail, putting his career on the line. But the thing I love about Memphis the most, and I know I was saying, like, oh, doesn't it suck when you tune in and it's Lance isn't there or Dave isn't there? But the true magic of Memphis wrestling is that you can tune in at any point. You can pick any episode from the 80s and just watch it. And you can kind of immerse yourself in it as kind of a standalone thing. Sort of like Mid-South. I think I probably had the same talking point about them. But those are my two favorite non-WWF, WCW shows. In fact, I probably watch more Memphis and Mid-South at this point than I do WCW because there's just not, for whatever reason, for a long time on YouTube, there was not a lot of WCW programming on there. And it looks like it's starting to get filled back up again. In fact, maybe I should just have it in part of my watch more wrestling, carve out more time. And I was carving out time to watch NWA Power for quite a while. And I've fallen well behind on that. Maybe I should just watch one episode of Memphis Wrestling every Tuesday night instead of NWA Power, because Jim Cornette, after that whole thing with the Ethiopian and the fried chicken, I know that's a joke he's told before, but there's a lot of jokes out there that after a while, I mean, clearly, whoever was editing that show said, I've heard Cornette do this bit before, and I'm not editing out. But apparently, the way the culture is, and I know I called Cornette a dumbass, but that's more from the perspective of, the dude gets so unbelievably angry about everything, he's not willing to walk anything back. And I say that as a driver in the New England region who pretty much wants to strangle every single car that's in front of me for my entire hour commute. But I don't do it. And I don't go on Twitter and say every single, you know, thought towards that end. It's like when I see Cornette's Twitter, it's so funny because he kind of reminds me of a certain politician that is the president of the United States who feels the need to reveal every single thought he has over Twitter when that's probably not necessary. So I think, you know, maybe limit your social media exposure, let's say. I don't know how I got off on this tangent, but, you know, Memphis in place of NWA Power. Should probably get back to watching Power because I did like it for the 3-4 episodes that I did watch it. Now, this show, this Memphis episode, April 2nd, 1988, which, by the way, I already did a show from this exact date from the WWF back, God, one of the first 10 episodes that I did, the one where Hacksaw Jim Duggan hits Andre over the head with the 2x4. This one has a parking lot incident between Eddie Gilbert and Jerry the King Lawler, but not the parking lot incident that you might be thinking of from, I guess it turns out, a couple of years after this. But this one's still plenty good, I think. But I'm also looking for other hooks to the show. And with Memphis, it's usually easy to find that sort of thing. Like, I've marked so many Memphis episodes for upcoming to do for this podcast. Like, ones when Hulk Hogan was there in 79. Ones when the Rockers showed up in late 87 and into 88. I love doing stuff like that. But also, debuts of guys in Memphis. And we got two of them here. One of them would become a bigger star than the other in Scott Steiner, who, no mask for him here, like there was in 1989 as the Wrestling Machine, but Tom Brandy makes his debut in Memphis Wrestling. I don't know why I'm laughing. Maybe it's because I'm thinking of Salvatore Sincere or the fact that he, like, stole the Patriot gimmick or something to that effect. We also see Scotty the Body as an enhancement talent, the man they call Raven. And this show also has more Brickhouse Brown than you could possibly ever want in your life. So if you enjoy his shoot interviews, you'll probably enjoy this because he has multiple matches on this program. So without any further ado, let us kick it off for Memphis Wrestling, April 2nd, 1988. Forgotten that Tiffany took the song I Saw Her Standing There by the Beatles and decided to flip it and change it to I Saw Him Standing There as number 17 in the American Top 40 for April 2nd, 1988. It's not exactly Billy Joel and Paul McCartney doing that song at Shea Stadium, which gets played on the Billy Joel channel on Sirius, it seems like every hour, but hey, you know, I guess it'll just have to do for now. So we start out, as all Memphis shows would do, with Lance and Dave at the desk. And for whatever reason, watching this, when they're running down the show, I just get a real kick out of the crowd popping for just them saying random names.
Oh, get ready. We got an opening match today with Brickhouse Brown coming in here to battle Scotty the Body. Should be a fine opening match today. A bit later on, we'll have Ron and Don, the Bruise Brothers, in a tag team match.
Mm-hmm.
The Gilberts will be here, Tommy and Doug. And a little bit later on, we will have Steve Kern in here as part of the tag team.
So weird to hear girls screaming for Ron and Don Harris. You know them as the guys who had the Nazi tattoos these days, but back in the 80s, girlies used to go wild for It was a different time. The Steve Kern one's a little bit more conventional. Although Dave says he's going to be there at a tag team, but it's actually a singles match a little bit later on. As Lance does kick us off after we get the beautiful Memphis bumper going to commercial. I know that's the one criticism I've had of Memphis shows is they introduce it, they tell us what's going to be on the show, and then they throw it right to commercial, which seems like an odd choice. You should probably have a match, but you know, who am I to, you know, say, who am I to question Memphis's methods since they stayed around longer than any of the other territories? Lance is kicking us off, but he's, for whatever reason, he's got a stall. And if you need somebody to do that on a wrestling program, Lance Russell is probably the master at that. Just vamp for a few minutes because you know somebody is supposed to be out there. He's probably in the John taking a whiz. He's going to wipe his ass, but he took the kind of dump where it's kind of sticking to his bottom and, you know, it's not coming off. And they only have the one-ply toilet paper at the WMC studios in Memphis. And then you run out and you have to get a second roll of toilet paper. I'm not saying Brickhouse Brown was taking a cramp or anything, but you know, a lot of stalling takes place before he emerges with Brother Ernest Angel, a rather infamous character from early 1988. And I know I just said character, but Brickhouse Brown, he's known for being a legendary shoot interview guy. Brother Ernest Angel is not really best known for anything other than being an overtly religious character that is in the form of a televangelist. And you can draw a straight line between him and Brother Love. The thing with Brother Love, though, is, yeah, that might be a ripoff of the Brother Ernest Angel character, but there's less overt religious overtones with that, which is a good idea by the WWF if they're going to take such a character to use the word love instead of God. It's funny that Bruce Pritchard played that character that was kind of taken from the Memphis territory, since all he ever does is kill and crap on Memphis and Jerry Jarrett every chance he gets. So this Ernest Angel guy, he even had altar boys. And by the way, I think I said this when the show I did after I got back from the christening, baptism on Long Island. Like, I saw the altar boys rehearsing beforehand with the priests, and all I could think was, you know, back in my day, the altar boys, they called it in the ring. They didn't go over everything in the performance center beforehand with Father O'Brien or whoever the hell it is. But anyway, Brickhouse is out of the John or wherever he was, and he's got a live mic, and that's always entertaining.
Shut up, yo, fool. These people know who I am.
Yeah.
I don't need no introduction. But for those of you who don't know, I'm Brickhouse, master of seduction. Now let me tell all you suckers something right now. Just when you thought it was safe to get back in the ring, here come the Brickhouse with his bull jive game. I'm ready to thump and bump like I left off doing the last time I was here. And I'm ready to slap this suck upside his nappy head.
But not only Brickhouse, he is a member of my coalition, which gives him, so much great power. And he's come back. He's a member of the coalition.
And I'm going to show him the light, Daddy.
That is obliquely wrestling related. I'm going to show him the light or show him the lights, which in wrestling is the guy who loses the match. When he gets pinned, he's staring up at the lights. So I don't know, maybe I'm reaching on that, but I do think it's a good bit of wordplay from Brickhouse and Reverend Ernest Angel, who I haven't seen a lot of this particular character, but I do enjoy when he starts proselytizing or whatever it is to Lance Russell.
Don't you just feel wonderful just being around us?
Boy, it really does the job.
I can just feel your heart all the way over here. Just I can see your hands kind of clammy. So we're going to go on over here.
Uh-huh, fine. That's the best place for you.
Just thinking about him as Lance Russell, the announcer character on Memphis Wrestling, think of all the crap that he saw and heard during his time there. And the fact that he would virtually never lose his mind at any of this, he would just sort of roll his eyes and be like, okay, yep, sure, over there is probably the best place for you. It's probably the way I should react to the person in front of me driving instead of becoming enraged, like I said a little bit earlier. So why don't we go to our first match, which is Brickhouse Brown taking on Scotty the Body, the man they call Raven, who is billed from Palm Beach, Florida. Which I did not, even though I flew into the Palm Beach airport, which is, I think, is recommended if you're going to the Miami area, because a little bit less hectic there than Fort Lauderdale and the Miami airport, at least as I understand it anyway. It was closer to where I was staying. Pretty good place. I thought was in Palm Beach, but apparently isn't. Apparently it's Lake Worth, Florida, called Benny's on the Beach. I liked it quite a bit. It's right on the water. Some good brunch. I didn't really have a good brunch when I was down there, and we had that as we were leaving. But anyway, Scott Levy. All right, whatever. I'm going to go with Scott Levy for this episode. He's so new in 1988 that 1988 is his first year listing on Cage Match. So he's relatively new to this. So with him in there against Brickhouse, I'm not expecting a whole lot. I know he goes to Portland for a couple of years. I know in 89 he's up there. Now, Brickhouse, he passed away, I believe, in 2018. I remember hearing about his death when I was at Fenway Park. It's like, why do I remember where I was when I found out that Brickhouse Brown died? Well, actually, as it turns out, he did not pass away. It was the same today, oddly enough, as Brian Christopher. But Brickhouse, I think, passed away like 2 or 3 days after the false alarm report that had come out. One thing I did not remember at all about Brickhouse, having watched my share of WWF, there, you know, I don't watch a lot of WWF from the summer of 86 because it is kind of an odd period where not a lot is happening, but that happens to be when Brickhouse Brown had a little run during the summertime in 86. It didn't really stick for whatever reason, but he always strikes me as a territory guy who would have fit in Crockett or WWF if they knew how to use him, but that just never really came to be. And he goes right to work with a right hand and then a snapmare and follows up with two elbows and then a back elbow off an Irish whip. And I'm getting a little worried that our old friend Scotty the Body is just going to get dominated here. But then he hits a body blow, and runs into a foot vertical suplex, and Scotty actually fights back with a monkey flip out of the corner. So he is getting a little bit of offense, but his O'Connor roll attempt is reversed out where the momentum carries Brickhouse Brown over the top, and that is actually how Brickhouse Brown picked up the win over Scotty the Body on a reversed O'Connor roll. Now, needless to say, that was not what I expected in the least. With the way Brickhouse came out, clearly it was under the impression that he hadn't been there for a while, you know, kind of talking shit about everybody. He's got the Reverend Ernest Angel there with him. So I was expecting, like, dude hits his finisher, picks up a, you know, convincing victory, not a reversal of an O'Connor roll. And watching this, I think Brickhouse might feel the same way, because he makes his way over to the commentary table, and he and the Rev have got some grievances to air against both Lance and Dave.
Who's still the baddest in this town? Huh?
You got to win, Brickhouse.
Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Brother Ernest.
You get a little excited. You always get excited when it's one of them Lawlers or one of them Jets or Mort. One of my boys gets excited. He don't do nothing. Give me a little. That's where
I'm excited, Brother Ernest. I'm excited, believe me.
I'm thrilled. I really am.
All right.
I love the way Dave is just like, I'm thrilled. I really am. I'm just thrilled. It reminds me of the SNL skit from later in 1988 where they lampooned Mike Dukakis' lack of passion.
Your leadership style has been described as being technocratic, cool, and emotionally dead. Even your closest advisors admit that sometimes you're distant and aloof, a bit of a cold fish. Opponents are saying that one of the reasons you trail in the polls is that you're uninspiring and seem to be devoid of passion.
Sam, what's the question?
Well, I guess the question, Governor, is do you think you have the necessary passion to lead this country?
Well, Sam, that kind of aspersion on my character quite frankly makes me, well, there's no other word for it, enraged. Enraged.
Oh, for the days when Saturday Night Live could use actual cast members in those high-profile spots instead of importing some A-list celebrity from somewhere to get the cheap pop. That kind of sounds like a wrestling promotion of recent years, bringing in the big names from the past. But anyway, enough about that. You got to create new stars, is my point. And that's what Memphis is constantly trying to do. Sometimes it would work, and sometimes it wouldn't. And up next, we have, as I said earlier, I'm sorry I keep laughing every time I want to talk about Tom Brandy, but this is his debut here, and the run does not last very long, and his cage match is rather hilarious, in my opinion, given how many indies Tom Brandy worked in the 2000s, because when you look up stuff on Cage Match, yes, it's a very valuable resource, but it's not going to cover every single independent promotion. So when you see, like, the year, I don't know, 2008, and there's, like, 17 different things, there's actually probably more promotions that he worked for in that year. It's just that they can't fit it all or they don't have the results. As I said, Tom Brandy, Salvatore Sincere in 95, 96, whatever it was, WWF. 97, where they did the undress him angle, like, your name's Tom Brandy, saith Mark Merrow, or the Patriot, as he stole the gimmick, as I mentioned earlier. Lance, in kind of introducing him, mentions a stint that he had in the USFL, and I couldn't find anything relating to that in any of his bios. USFL stats can be a little spotty, especially if you're not playing a skill position, and I don't know where Tom Brandy would have played if he had played on defense. I'm sure defensive stats were not kept all that well in the USFL since it was the years 83 through 85. So Lance Russell giving him the nice little introduction, but, you know, in return, Tom Brandy's got to kiss his ass a little, tickle his balls.
It's my pleasure to meet you. All my, you know, all the time I've been watching wrestling, I see your face on the screen, and, you know, I haven't been in the sport that long, but all I know is this is the place to be, the hotbed of wrestling. Championship wrestling territory, and I figured it's about time I start making a name for myself in this territory right here.
Suppose if you did grow up watching championship wrestling from Memphis and you know Lance Russell from the TV, you might be a little bit starstruck if you're coming in and appearing on the show for the first time, but since you're a professional wrestler now, you got to kind of keep it together. You can't turn into Louise Jefferson when she meets Sammy Davis Jr. on that All in the Family episode that I love so much. Oh my God, it's you! And then when she kisses him, and basically like a dusting of sexual assault of Sammy Davis Jr. But you know, you got to keep it together here. I mean, he's got some credibility to maintain for whatever it was that Tom Brandy was going to have. But he is going to have his first match here against Reddy. And I almost want to call him Randy Reddy, like the baseball player from the 80s, who I think played for the Giants and the Twins, I think. But no, it was Reddy, one half of the tag team Rough and Reddy from Memphis, that I know I covered them on a previous episode, but they were a very interesting group in that they were very much a jobber tag team, but they had a manager for much of that time, which is a little bit curious. Brandy, for his part, is billed from Chippendales, New York, which I was unaware. Like, does he actually live in the building where the Chippendales dancers are? He's kind of billed that way, too, so kind of a Brutus Beefcake vibe, I guess. Or maybe they meant to say Chappaqua, New York, but no, they actually said Chippendales, New York City. And this match, it's unbelievable because we get a complete screw-up of an O'Connor roll. Yes, that very same move we saw in the last match that finished things off. And Reddy couldn't really kick out of it. And I'm just like, what the hell is going on? And the manager, the aforementioned manager of Reddy, Boss Winters, he's very upset, and he yells at Lance and Dave, saying this was a complete ripoff, that, you know, this isn't right. This match only lasted 12 seconds, so we got to do this again. We got to have another match between Tom Brandy and Reddy.
I mean, I have to admit, I was very confused watching this, and I thought it might have been because I hadn't had my coffee the morning that I was viewing this, and maybe I was imagining things, maybe I had too much to drink the night before that the match is over in 12 seconds, but also, on the roll-up, it looked like Reddy was unable to kick out, or like Brandy was not allowing a kick out to happen, like one of those deals, but no, this is all part of what they're trying to accomplish. So, Boss Winters, he wants the rematch, and we're going to get one immediately.
We want a match!
You want a match?
You just had a match.
There's no way that this little girl dancer is going to beat an athlete like Reddy. He wasn't ready.
Okay.
He had him by the tie.
There, you want another match?
Yeah.
Yeah, let's go. Let's go.
Brandy picks him up, slams him down. Three, and there you go. That was even quicker, Dave.
It was even quicker.
Yeah, it just ends with a back suplex and a roll-up for the three count. So I guess you could say he wasn't ready. I'll tell you who was ready, and it's Mr. Brickhouse Brown, who emerges from the back again to air some more grievances, but more importantly, to rescue us from this very, very dark timeline, which is just an endless loop of Tom Brandy versus Reddy matches.
The last time I was out here, you're still out here going on like it's 250 years ago today, you know what I mean? Trying to have a brother embarrassed like this. This is a conspiracy. Hey! Hey, he's trying to make the brother look bad. Come here, boss. Come here. If he want to make the brother look bad, why don't he test himself and come and face me, huh?
Yeah.
Why don't
you want some, huh?
If he want to embarrass the brother, I'm the man for him. You understand?
Well, if there's anybody in the studio audience at WMC on that day, say, well, we already saw this match at the Mid-South Coliseum the previous Monday night. Which, by the way, it did not have a conclusive ending as Tom Brandy and Brickhouse Brown went to a double countout. So there's still something left to settle, and we're going to have the rematch right here, even though Brandy has had two hard-fought bouts totaling under 40 seconds, and Brickhouse had his one match that was a minute 22 or whatever it was. So now we're cramming in our fourth match in not very long, but hey, I mean, it's all part of a natural storyline and progression on this program. Brickhouse just beats the crap out of Brandy early on with some three right hands, just beating him up, but good. Gut-wrench suplex, and then tosses Brandy to the outside. And then back inside, Brickhouse puts his head down, a cardinal mistake for a ring veteran, and Brandy hits the Miracle Sunset Flip and gets a three count out of it. So a bit of a mild upset for whatever reason, at least maybe it's just in my own head. But as I look ahead to the following Monday night in the Mid-South Coliseum on April 4th, Brickhouse did beat Tom Brandy in that one. And then the following Monday on April 11th, Brandy beat Brickhouse Brown by disqualification. So out of all that, this is the only time Brandy gets a pin on Brickhouse Brown. I'm not entirely sure what I'm watching here, but after the bout, Brickhouse decides that he's had enough of this crap, so the beatdown commences. He actually throws Tom Brandy into the ring post, and he's just sick of this guy, and Brandy is now bleeding, so we get some blood on Saturday Memphis TV. And it's at this point that I notice the front of the ring, if you watch Memphis wrestling, during this era, especially, you'll see a sign for Covington Pike Toyota. And I thought to myself, is that actually still around? And when I looked it up, it appeared to still be there, except that there was something with that on... That particular dealership was on 60 Minutes for a little dishonest thing. I know, a car dealership was doing something dishonest, where they would say that the interest rate that they were charging was one thing, but then they would pad that interest rate knowing that the difference between that and what they actually were getting was going into the pockets of those working at the dealership via commissions or whatever. So it was a bit of a scandal, but when you look it up, there appears to be a car dealership at the address in Memphis where Covington Pike Toyota was. But it's not labeled on Google Maps. I thought it was a little weird. It might be that the place next door expanded, Who knows? Anyway, Tom Brandy, in case you still care about him, he fires up with a dropkick, makes a little bit of a Spirit of 76 comeback as Brickhouse bails to the back. And yeah, I've had some fun at the expense of Tom Brandy and how many matches we've had so far, with there being four at this point. But we're literally on a pace in a 45-minute program, you know, taking out the commercials and all, to somehow have more matches here than there were on the WrestleMania 4 card the week before. Like most of the other Memphis shows that I've done, in fact, might actually be all of them, have come from the Memphis feed of the show. So the local promo is going to be for the show there on the following Wednesday. And there's no results for it that I found, but I think I have a pretty good handle on how these matches went, with Jerry Lawler versus Eddie Gilbert, no referee, Tennessee Street Fight. Eddie Marlin and Tommy Gilbert, they have a little thing going, and Jeff Jarrett is facing off against Doug Gilbert, and Lance just running down the card. There's no promo at this time. So we go right into the next match. Those heartthrobs, the Bruise Brothers, Ron and Don Harris, with hair. When you think of 8-Ball and Skull, yes, Skull, they have blonde flowing locks at this particular point in time. Their main concern is getting another crack at the tag team titles that they had lost the previous month to Gary Young and Max Payne. However, those guys are not going to agree to a rematch unless some sort of collateral is put up in the agreement. So instead of putting up any of their World War II memorabilia that I'm pretty sure that the Harris twins have in great abundance, I'll let you, you know, use your imagination as to which side that memorabilia might be from. They get help from a friend, man, Mark Miller of the band Sawyer Brown, a band that, yes, they were around in 1988, but they would actually grow to greater fame in the 90s. I remember them winning a bunch of music awards at some point in the middle of the decade. But he's here to kind of offer up some collateral to get his pals that tag team title shot.
A lot of people know about our association with the Bruise Brothers. And I tell you, we're just as proud as we can be of them. We have been watching their videotapes on the buses when we've been on the road.
I guess we've come a long way from the 70s when Jackson Brown sang about the stuff that they had on the bus in the loadout. I know I've talked about that song in the past where Jackson Brown is a total dick. Like, all right, I want you to move all my stuff, but I want you to leave the piano for last because it's heaviest and it's the hardest thing to actually find room for. But in any event, you know, they got country and western on the bus. And now, in the 80s, they apparently watch Bruise Brothers matches.
Everybody knows they haven't been wrestling in a long time. They don't have a lot of money. And I remember back, there was a fella by the name of Kenny Rogers about 3 years ago who helped me out in my career. And I think that you should pass things along.
I tried to check into the veracity of, did Kenny Rogers actually help Sawyer Brown at some point in time? And the answer is almost undoubtedly yes, because Kenny Rogers has like more duets with other people or like other groups than pretty much anybody in history, at least that I can think of.
I feel confident enough in Ron and Don that they're going to win the belts back, and I'm willing up to put anything up for the belts. And this baby right here is the hardest thing I ever had to work for. Brother Ernest, this is a gold album, dude. And this is one thing that, as an entertainer or a recording artist, that the most coveted award that you can get. And I'm putting this thing up in confidence that Ron and Don Bruise are going to be the next Mid-South heavyweight champs.
I get the sense, and I could be wrong on this, that they got Mark Miller to appear for this, to be their celebrity that they would bring in, not because they paid him a lot of money, because Memphis was not known for being a territory that was going to make these grand expenditures on such things. I think he wanted to do this and just be part of a wrestling storyline, like, it'll be a cool thing to do for a while. And of course, the gold belt goes up, the Bruise Brothers, they win the tag team titles back in time, and the Reverend Ernest Angel kind of fades off into the sunset shortly thereafter. See, his little gimmick was actually something called the Good Book, which is basically hit the guys with a Bible or a very large book. I feel like Leon Uris would probably work pretty well in that regard. So a neat little footnote in Memphis history, bringing in a guy from Sawyer Brown to take part in an angle in the tag team division. In the meantime, though, in the here and now, we do get a response from the Reverend Ernest Angel.
Bring all the gold records on, because at Wrestling USA, we're going to pave the street with gold records. That's how many we'll take. That's how many records we'll take from you and your Sawyer Brown or Buster Brown. What about the dog tag? Y'all going to put him up too?
Yeah, hey, listen, these guys are out here.
What?
They've met a stipulation. They came up with something
record.
In order to...
What do you think we're going to do, melt it down and make a nugget?
A valuable gold record, much more valuable than anything that you've got to offer in there. Here's something that they, Sawyer Brown, worked hard all their career, and they've got, and they're willing to back
friends
right here and put that thing up in order to
you
get a
back. You got a violin back there where I can play it?
We don't need
any of
that kind
of... We'll pave the street with gold records.
Well,
by the way, don't forget we can get that condominium.
Paving anything with gold records just feels entirely impractical. I know it's probably just a figure of speech. Even though it doesn't snow in Memphis, I feel like you'd scrape it somehow. I don't know. It could very easily be damaged. That's all that I'm saying there. But, hey, credit to Sawyer Brown. He's basically co-signing a loan here by putting up this collateral because he doesn't really have anything to gain. This is an extremely risky venture. It is like co-signing a friend's car loan, which, by the way, I don't recommend anybody do. I almost did that once, and I'm glad that I didn't. So why don't we go right to the match with the Bruise Brothers, Ron and Don Harris. They're taking on the Blue Knight and Keith Eric. Now, I want to note that Keith Eric is African-American. No particular reason why I'm pointing that out, him facing Ron and Don Harris. And Keith Eric is a veteran of the process. And no, there is no Eric Keith, at least that I know of. And when I say veteran of the process, he's been in Memphis for a long time. He's probably on one of the other Memphis shows that I've covered. And the Blue Knight is not Greg the Hammer Valentine, who is the Blue Knight at the 93 Survivor Series. Definitely not the same guy. A drop kick on the Blue Knight, a vertical suplex. I'm not even going to bother to figure out which Harris twin is in there. A vertical suplex that's almost like a half regular, half snap suplex. And then a very awkward looking backdrop. And then a standing drop kick, for which I will give props, because when big guys do standing drop kicks, I'm a fan of that. And the on the pinfall attempt, this was actually kind of a fun finish, because you don't see this very often, where Keith Eric comes into the ring to try and bake up the pin. He kicks the Harris twin in the back, but he doesn't actually budge, so the pinfall is recorded. Usually when you see a guy making a save in, like, the modern product, a guy, you know, you kick him lightly and they roll off the guy. I've never understood that. If you're doing the save, shouldn't you be doing something to actually pull the guy off rather than just tapping him lightly with your foot? So, pretty nice creative finish for this enhancement match that's no more than 2 minutes, and I'm just floored that this is Eight Ball and Skull. For the next segment, it is not unlike ECW in the mid-90s, where you would hear Highway to Hell by AC/DC, and then all of a sudden a parade of Dudleys, big and small, would emerge from the back. Instead, here we get a parade of the Gilbert family, both large and, well, I guess not that large. I mean, there's nobody the size of Big Dick Dudley or anything like that, but we get three different Gilberts, Tommy, Doug, and of course, Eddie. His wife, the lovely Missy Hyatt, and a young girl who's going to be identified shortly. So, kind of like the Undisputed Era in NXT, the Gilberts are kind of running roughshod over Memphis wrestling at this particular point in time, except I am Gilbert, and I don't particularly care for Adam Cole, even though he's got, you know, the 5-inch pythons going on, brother. I'm sorry, I just don't get Adam Cole. Can somebody freaking explain this to me? I saw him facing Michael Elgin at, like, an ROH pay-per-view 3 years ago. I felt the exact same way then. I was like, I don't like this Elgin guy because he looks exactly like Boris Zukov, and this was before the whole sexual harassment thing or whatever the hell happened with him a couple of years ago. And Adam Cole, I just don't get it. Look, I'm sorry. I'm you know, you might agree with me on a lot of stuff. I'm just not going to come around on a number of things. So the Gilbert family is out there, but yeah, the little girl, that's a little confusing why she's out there, because Eddie and Missy don't have a kid or anything, so go ahead, Missy, tell us who this child is.
Lance, I just wanted to show y'all, I want her to turn around here, I just want to let everyone see that royalty runs in the Gilbert family. Yeah. This is Miss Jennifer Wood, and she's a little Miss USA, and I just had to show everybody
my niece,
her.
My niece, royalty, queen.
Isn't she cute? And her crown,
she is a lovely little girl.
And her crown's real, not like Jerry Lawler's, too.
Yeah. Well.
All right, so JonBenet is apparently, Jennifer is a niece of the Gilbert family who won Little Miss USA or Little Miss Tennessee USA. Now, let me tell you something right now. This is one of the shows I mentioned I watched down in Florida, and I'm in the living room of this condo at like 7 a.m. watching this, and I'm doing a furious Google search trying to look up the history of Little Miss USA, Little Miss Tennessee, to try and find a little bit more on this Jennifer Wood that's out there. And I can assure you, that is a very dangerous game, because I'm looking for information on, like, 8-year-old beauty contestant winners, which I think automatically makes me a level 2 sex offender. So, just, all I'm saying is be careful when you do stuff like that. But in any event, I did eventually find something where she may have been principal of a school more recently, but I couldn't really tie the age back or even see if it was the same person. You know what? You're better off looking up who's Little Miss Springfield, the Amber Dempsey thing from one of the, I think it was season 4 of The Simpsons. So they're all there, Tommy, Doug, Eddie, like I said. So Doug Gilbert has access to an open microphone, which I know it's not 1999 Memphis when he went off and said all those things about Jerry Lawler that he probably shouldn't have said. In the immortal words of Orenthal James Simpson in that famous Howard Stern show drop that got played over and over again. Look out!
Gilbert, that's right.
Lance, how are you thinking? Jeff Jarrett thinks his granddaddy, his old man, Eddie Marlin, saved him last week. He's going to have his handcuffed. He's going to be handcuffed this week. He's not going to be able to save him. Jeff Jarrett thinks he's such an athlete. I'm going to take him. When I hit him with his fist, he's going to think he's playing basketball. I'm going to bang, bow, bow, bow. I'm going to beat his stinking brains right in the mat.
Now, he didn't accuse anybody of rape, so it's relatively uneventful compared with some other stuff. But I did think he was going to call Jeff Jarrett an asshole when he went to say athlete, which he turned into, I don't know. I know some people say athlete. I know Jesse Ventura says that on Superstars, and Vince has been like, what? Because it is kind of an odd pronunciation. Now, Tommy, the patriarch, is there. And he's in a thing with Eddie Marlin, kind of, I guess, think of this as like the senior PGA tour of the Memphis territory at this time, and he's going to be handcuffed to Eddie Marlin for this upcoming match. And he kind of puts over his, the way he puts over his son Doug, I find rather interesting.
Hanky Panky, who saved Jeff Jarrett and Eddie Marlin? Just tell me, who come to the ring, who done what? Me and the hitman here. What happened? Jeff Jarrett's laying out there with his own blood. Eddie Marlin, I told you would hurt, man. I told you'd hurt from in here. It ain't gonna hurt, you know. The straps on your back after a while, them leaves you. But this in here hurts, don't it? And that's exactly what we done. I told you I'd do it, and that's what I done. The hit man here. Do you know what this man is gonna do? Do you know what he's gonna do to Jeff? You're going to find out why this man is called the hitman. Everybody that played football against Lexington, they knew whenever he stepped out there what he was and what he could do. He got kicked out of more football games because of what he done. And I want to tell you what, Jeff Jarrett is going to understand and know why, because we're fixing to show you here just in a minute. Handcuff, that's fine. And then a street brawl with Eddie Marlin. You know something?
You got there? One of them coming up.
Do you know something? Can you imagine what Eddie Marlin's going to look like naked?
You come in with clothes on, somebody leaves without
clothes. Can you imagine
on.
What he's going to look like, Eddie?
No, I can't. No, I don't really see that.
With all due respect to the late Eddie Marlin, I'm not entirely sure that that's really kind of a drawing card. You know, come on down to the Mid-South Coliseum and see Eddie Marlin's balls. I don't think that that's going to get people out there. I guess maybe you're thinking, well, maybe he'll turn it around on him with some help. Who really knows? But Doug was thrown out of more football games. What was he like? The Vontaze Burfict of the Memphis like high school or whatever the hell it was. Like, oh, okay. He's thrown out of more football games because he was too violent. I there's no way for me to look up what his high school football record is. But hey, the real talker in this family to me is the great Eddie Gilbert, who unfortunately everybody else has said their piece. Well, I guess except for the little girl who probably you're just going to do beauty pageants to bat the fake eyelashes like the Amber Dempsey character from The Simpsons that I mentioned before. Unfortunately, Eddie's not very chatty right now.
Lance, I'm saving all my comments a little bit later on the show, okay?
That's good. A lot later would be even better.
I think Eddie was going to talk in that spot, but the thought of Eddie Marlin naked has shook him so badly that he's going to need a few moments to compose himself while Tommy and Doug hit the ring for a match now against the team of Alan Reynolds and Doug Dancing. Very odd name, Doug Dancing. It's like, you can pick any name you want to be a professional wrestler, and he chooses Doug Dancing. I don't understand it at all, but he does not even start the matches. Doug Gilbert and Alan Reynolds, who, Doug is wearing a full body suit, which I thought was a little odd. It just looks a little weird. I don't know if something was going on, but he jumps Reynolds right off the get-go, and then a catches him with his head down, hits him with a DDT, a cardinal mistake by a ring veteran. Yes, I know. And, oh my God, I had an episode like this a long time ago where Missy Hyatt was on commentary for WCW Main Event. And I did other ones around that time where she's not on commentary. And if you listen to episode, I think it's 18, you'll understand why they pulled her off there. But, oh my God, she's invaded the space. She's invaded the commentary desk with Lance and Dave.
You know what, Lance? I just left a minute ago because I had to take Jennifer back in the back, but I was just thinking about something. Can you imagine Eddie Marlin naked?
Now I'm not sure what I'm less comfortable with here, the thought of Eddie Marlin naked or that very young girl unsupervised backstage at a Memphis wrestling show in the late 80s. I don't know. It's kind of a toss-up between the two. I'm just going to leave that alone. As Doug Dancing is in along with Tommy Gilbert, who hits him with a vertical suplex. I think with this Doug Dancing guy, because apparently he had to have the last name Dancing. By the way, that would be a great Family Feud name. Please welcome the Dancing family. He should have turned heel and become Dirty Dancing. This is 1988. He would have been catching the trend when it was really hot, and he could have become like a Latin American or whatever. I know he's from Arkansas, but this is wrestling. Nobody is from where they say they are. Big spine buster by Doug finishes it off. Finishes off Doug Dancing, and all I got to say is...
It's dancing.
No. That ain't dancing, Sally.
You know, my idea is just crazy enough to work in Memphis. I think it's the only territory we could take a guy whose last name is Dancing and he's from Arkansas, turn him into Dirty Dancing, even though there's a lot of other dirties that come through there. Dutch Mantel, for one. I mean, he goes by the name Just Dirty on Family Feud, so why don't I just go right into the next one, which is Steve Kern facing off against Jesse Owens. No, not the 1936 Olympic gold medalist four times. Shove it right in Hitler's face. One of the great Olympic performances of all time. Steve Kern, I think, was the reason why when I was down in Florida, you know, where we are, Delray Beach, it's probably about an hour and 15 minutes from the Everglades, or at least, you know, the outer edge of it. It's probably a little bit further to the visitor center. I couldn't go to the Everglades because I was afraid I was going to run into somebody like Skinner there, or somebody who looks like Steve Kern, who's just so damn handsome and such an appeal, holds such a transcendent appeal to women. And I might end up losing my wife down there. I mean, you know, who knows what might happen? I mean, she seems to like my facial hair, and I know that Steve Kern can definitely do it better than me. Of course, he doesn't look the way that he did back in the 80s, so I don't know what the hell I'm fearing. It's just that I'm so stuck in that decade from watching pro wrestling from that era. The last run of the Fabs prior to this that I found was very early 1987 in Memphis. And eventually, Stan Lane goes down to Florida for a very brief period before he gets that phone call from Jim Cornette when Dennis Condrey kind of took off under mysterious circumstances. He goes up, joins the Midnight Express. At that point, Kern isn't wrestling all that frequently, although when he is, he's down in Florida teaming with Mike Graham. And he comes in for this run, and it appears to be fairly brief. Because Kern is one of those guys who would kind of come and go as he pleased. He's sort of a made man, you know, from being in the Fabs for most of the 80s. You know, always a dependable guy, and territories could always use somebody like that, especially if the crowds were familiar with them at all. I think the reason why he went to the WWF is, number one, for the money, and number two, he was allowed to play a character that was fun for him to portray because it was kind of, you know, I'm not saying that he hung out in the Everglades, as I was alluding to, but, you know, it was something a little bit more fun. And I've talked about this in previous episodes. The interesting thing about this squash match, not so much the mat work and the arm work by Steve Kern, and, you know, where he kind of rides the guy, Irish whip, hits a forearm and all that. I was more struck by listening to the way, and I've been writing a long love letter to Lance Russell, like this entire show and for most of the other Memphis shows that I've done. But, you know, this match is brief enough. Just playing a clip of Lance Russell calling this match, you can kind of take in just how good he is at this.
Bell time! And the fabulous one, Steve Kern, going against Jesse Owens. Haven't seen Jesse in quite some time. He has wrestled here with us on CWA before, but it's been a while. Tying up, Steve Kern. Rough kind. He went for a fireman's carry throw. Owens was trying to back up. He got a piece of him, and look at him hang in there with that wrist lock, take him right over and around. Boy, he really is working at a tough tempo. He's got that wrist lock on the side where he can go either way with it, and he chooses to go underneath. Pumps it again. Jesse Owens scooped up. Kern slams him down, dead center of the ring.
That's not the entire match, but it goes back to a point that I made in an earlier show about Lance Russell being the Vin Scully of professional wrestling broadcasters, this kind of folksy style that he has, and he can call this all by himself. I mean, I'm glad that Dave Brown is there. I don't mean to keep, like, kind of accidentally crapping on him or anything. It's just that Lance is so good at calling this, and it just the way, like, that's exactly what I want from my wrestling announcers, although I also like Gorilla Monsoon and occasionally Vince McMahon as well. So, I, you know, there's a variety of different things, but it just feels right when Lance Russell is calling it. And for those of you who aren't familiar with Vin Scully, he's a baseball announcer for about 65 years for the Dodgers, who had a very similar style of calling baseball that Lance Russell had calling wrestling. I could definitely connect the two, given that pro wrestling and baseball are two of my passions. This match is finished off with the sleeper by Steve Kern, who, because he's such a nice guy, he wakes up Jesse Owens after the match by kind of hitting him in the back of the neck, and he's kind of grabbing it awkwardly as he walks off. But like I said, this is not a run that lasts very long, so it's just kind of this weird interlude. Hey, here's Steve Kern in 1988, everybody.
All right, we're getting things set up over here in just a moment. I hear dial tones and things like that going on. I'm trying to get the phone set up so that Lance can be talking to the king here in just a moment.
As they came into this week's show, Lawler hadn't been appearing on TV the previous couple of weeks, but would call in for these segments with Lance Russell, which is perfectly fine because if he's not showing his face every single week, it's going to be longer before the people get sick of him. I mean, nobody can argue with Jerry Lawler's longevity in Memphis because it's pretty much unmatched. It's like him in Memphis, Bruno in New York, and maybe a handful of others. But those are the two that come to mind immediately. So Lance Russell getting Jerry Lawler on the phone. Is there anything more Memphis wrestling than that, other than maybe Jerry Jarrett listening in on a recorded, you know, on like tapping the phone line?
Yeah. Hey, Jerry. Lance. We want to get you on the phone out here today and talk about this situation with Gilbert, the son of gun. You know, when I say it's getting serious, I can't believe the stuff that they're pulling now.
Yeah, well, you know, I'll tell you, Lance, there's got to be a stop put to this one way or the other. You know, we're gonna get things working here shortly. You know, I've come back. I guess the first week maybe I came back a little bit too early, but now I feel real good. I'm ready to get things going here, and I got some surprises in store for Eddie Gilbert. I can assure you that.
Yeah. Well, I know. Yeah. Okay, hey, listen, come on.
All right, so Lawler's got some surprises in store for the Gilberts at some point down the road. Fine, well, it's at that point at the end where you hear Lance like, oh, God. Eddie Gilbert has emerged again. He no longer has the image of Eddie Marlin's balls dancing through his head. So he's going to grab the phone from Lance and tell Lawler right off.
Now, listen, as this is 3 weeks now, Lawler, if you're not man enough to come down here and face me man-to-man, why don't you quit calling, quit having Lance Russell call you? I'm sick of telling this. I'm the new king here. You only talk on this program when I want you to talk. Well, you're a gutless winner now, something, right?
Well, Gilbert, you can run your mouth all you want to, brother, but...
You're exactly right about that, if I want to, if I don't, so bye-bye, King!
This actually reminds me that in some ways, technology has made the world worse. And I know, I'm not talking about like the internet poisoning things and Twitter being a cesspool and Facebook being, you know, manipulated by all this stuff for political ends. I don't mean that. I'm talking about simple stuff like... You can't slam down a phone anymore, like in anger, like as an emphatic thing. Like, if you're going to hang up on somebody on a cell phone, they don't hear it. All you're doing is pushing a button. Like, you can't slam it down and have it make that noise. Like, you can't have good phone slammings these days. Not like in Goodfellas when they find out that Tommy got whacked.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who's this?
This is Vinny.
Vinny, what happened? Well, did we get straightened out?
No, we had a problem. I mean, we tried to do everything we could.
What do you mean?
Well, you know what I mean. He's gone. And we couldn't do nothing about it. That's it.
What do you mean? What do you mean?
He's gone. He's gone. And that's it.
Fuck. I can't believe it. I can't fucking.
See, that great scene all of a sudden sucks. If De Niro is just talking on a cell phone in the booth in the restaurant where he just pushes a button and it makes no noise, it's basically would boil down to De Niro doing the sniveling, crying thing that I know Keithy hates so much whenever De Niro does that. So it would have harmed the scene, you know, him banging against the phone, against the hook in the phone booth. That's classic. We've lost that in this modern era, or, you know, maybe there are still some payphones out there. Probably at the airport. I should have looked around at the Palm Beach airport. But even Lance, okay, he, as I said, he's seen a lot of crap in that Memphis studio. But he calls Eddie rude, and quite frankly, he's sick of this shit.
Rude, vile, pig.
It's my country.
You know what I mean? Rude, vile, pig.
Hello?
That's what
I want.
See, Lance Russell, he's too polite to actually vocalize it, so I'm just going to play the clip of Elton John trying to leave Taiwan, calling everybody rude, vile pigs. I don't know what year that was. Probably around like 04 or 05. It's so classic. I've never actually seen Elton John live. I should probably go to one of those farewell tours that he always seems to be having. But Lance, as I said, he's really sick of this, and Lawler's probably sick of this, you know, wherever he is. So, they've come up with a little something here.
You're mad because I got there and hung up on your precious king.
Yeah, well, you think I'm going to like it for you coming out here every single week and trying to interrupt our program and do it.
We can do whatever we want to.
You may just find out, Missy, that you can't do everything that you want to. And you better...
I'm glad you're sick and tired, Lance, because, you know, this past week, when I was talking to my brother Doug and my dad Tommy and Missy this week, and you know, and I was thinking about all the legends, since I've been known as a legend slayer now, right? All the legends that I've put out the pasture. The first one, of course, was your king, Jerry Lawler. He's gone. He won't even show up on TV anymore. Then was your stupid star, Bill Dundee. I sent him on his way. And then came the big millionaire, Jerry Jarrett, who's got logging coming and everything. He won't even show up here to see his boys. I put him back out again. And then I started thinking, who's the person that's left? And then it hit me. I said, the greatest legend in the Mid-South area I've overlooked, how can I do this? The Ancient Mariner himself, Lance Russell.
All right. And don't get into that.
Today, I just happen to have a little surprise for you.
All right. Now, listen, Eddie.
What?
I got a little surprise for you, maybe.
What?
Yeah, I got a little surprise. You know Jerry Lawler? I was just talking to him before you interrupted on that. You know where I was calling to him for?
Sure, his house.
Think again. You got another thing coming. I was talking to him right out of the lobby of this television station. Jerry Lawler is right here. Right there. You got something to say to me. You go say it to him.
This is so great because Lance Russell does not get involved in this sort of stuff on a regular basis. He's so sick of what Eddie Gilbert has been doing. Kind of a legend killer gimmick, kind of reminiscent of Randy Orton in 2005, I think it was. That's kind of a blind spot for me, but, you know, once again, pulling the old angles from Memphis, although it may have been done before this, obviously, you know, I can connect dots between the two of them. But Lance is so sick of it that he concocts this plan to have sneak Lawler to the studio and have him there and then fake a phone conversation and make it seem like Lawler was at home because you don't have cell phones. I mean, very few people had cell phones in the car at that point. And you make it seem like, oh, well, he's not here again this week. And now you've set up this brawl for Jerry Lawler and Eddie Gilbert to go at it either all over the studio or all over the parking lot. You know, they have at it, and they fight their way through the hallway to the outside, and they actually have to go to commercial, and it is, I've watched a lot of Memphis wrestling shows in the last couple of years while doing this podcast. This is by far my favorite going to commercial thing that Memphis has ever done, with the cool bumper, and they're like, Eddie's selling in, like, not his gear, but it looks like he might have wrestling boots on. I can't really tell. You know, the video quality isn't all that great, but they're doing stuff to each other in the parking lot, and just hearing that Memphis music over it, it just feels right seeing it all. Like, Lawler has him in the headlock and does that little short fist to his face right before it cuts out for the commercial. It's so great. Especially, you know, just the thing of, like, Lance Russell, he's had enough that he's going to mislead Eddie Gilbert and kind of entrap him.
Well, I'll tell you one thing. I don't approve of these fights in the studio and all of that, but this is one of them that I can't cry about. If anybody ever had it coming, that Gilbert had it coming. He's done everything. He didn't mention the fact he burned Randy Hales along with everybody else that he's burned. So we just thought he would let him think that Jerry Lawler was not around and out of the home. Lawler pounded on him. Whoa, there they go. Watch the folks.
Back in the corner by the door, back there. That's a big sandbag. Lawler slammed into the door. He returns it to Gilbert. Look out. Well, they're out in an area that has no lighting out there. Follow them as long as you can.
Davey?
Yeah.
They're battling outside here. I tell you what we got to do. Let's us just take a break right here. Lawler going out after him. Let's take a break. And we'll come back and catch it, see if we can get the camera set. Okay? Let's take a break.
There's still a lot of meat left on that bone with the fight outside with Gilbert and Lawler, but as they come back, they're doing a promo for the upcoming Wednesday show in Evansville, and we got Jeff Jarrett, which I can't say that I'm entirely thrilled about, but now that we know a little bit more about Doug, don't call me Vontaze Gilbert, in his football career, maybe I'm mildly interested to hear what Jeff has to say and how he's going to approach the match with him. Along with Eddie Marlin, who thankfully is fully clothed at the moment.
You know, last week you and your daddy, yeah, he's going to be handcuffed at ringside this week, and so is Eddie. You two did bust my head open last week, but this week it's going to be an entirely different story. It's going to be one-on-one, and Doug, you better show up because you're going to see a fight.
Hey, Eddie, you got a Tennessee street fight.
That's right, but before that I'm going to be handcuffed across the ring where I can see Tommy Gibbs' face when Jeff is beating up on Doug. And then, Tommy, you came out here and said you want to fight me. Well, I'm tired of getting in the ring every week. I'm too old, I told you, to fight every week. So this time it's a Tennessee street fight. I do it best that way, Tommy. And I'm going to beat your brains out, and I'm going to end this because, like I say, I'm tired of getting in there every week.
Well, that's all very good to hear, but we got to get back to the parking lot brawl with Lawler and Gilbert because they just got out there. And there's a rich history in professional wrestling history of just matches occurring in parking lots, fights occurring in parking lots. Hell, this isn't going to be the last time Lawler and Gilbert in that parking lot. I'm pretty sure that I've seen professional wrestling in a parking lot somewhere. In fact, I think outside Lowell Spinner's Baseball, well, maybe that was the sidewalk and not the parking lot, but it's all kind of a technicality. I mean, I think Yankee Pro up here in New England has run parking lot shows. I mean, like I said, there's a rich history of it. Even me, okay, participated in a parking lot match behind the Star Market in Alston, Massachusetts after WrestleMania 15. Pretty pissed drunk at the time, but I scored the win with a perfect plex against an unnamed assailant. I didn't even know the guy. All I know is that he looked a lot like X-Pac, and it just kind of annoyed me, you know, long before people became annoyed and coined the term X-Pac heat. I remember doing a dumpster spot where I dove into a dumpster, which is a pretty dangerous game. I mean, that Star Market in Alston, that was no joke at that time. But yeah, doing that perfect plex. I remember I did the bridge and everything. Man, when I was 19, 20 years old, I could actually, you know, do stuff for a fairly big guy. But anyway, they're fighting around outside, and the great part is, you know, the WMC studio in Memphis, that's still in the same place today that it was back then 30 years ago. And yeah, that probably makes sense. Probably don't move everywhere. The parking lot is a little bit different, where the cars now park behind a fence, probably for security reasons. But in the background, you can see the Midtown Church of Christ, which is pretty much the same as it was in 1988. It's all there. And they're fighting. Lawler ends up going into the windshield of what may or may not be Dave Brown's car. Now, he does not sell it like, oh my God, that's my car. Probably because Dave, if it was his car, he knows he's got comprehensive insurance coverage. He's got glass coverage. So he's going to get a new windshield out of the deal. But my question is, if that was Dave Brown's car, why was he parked, being a meteorologist at the station, WMC5 in Memphis, why did he have to park in visitor parking? That's the thing I don't get.
Side, we've got the camera out there at the parking lot. Jerry Lawler and Eddie Gilbert started fighting right in here. Fought all the way out the building. They're out in, that is a parking lot on the side of the TV station. And Lawler and Gilbert are just going straight at it. Lawler slams Gilbert's head down on the hood of a car. A street brawl. Lawler picks Gilbert up, and Gilbert swings back, tagging away, and Lawler picks Jerry up, slams him right down into the windshield. Lawler, good night. He busted him right down into that windshield.
One thing I have to note is there are a handful of people in the parking lot who are just watching this. And sometimes in Memphis, the people watching it would feel it would get a little too real. Well, when Lawler gets run over by the car driven by Eddie Gilbert a couple of years later, there were people who called the cops after that. Of course, there's maybe one or two people in the studio audience inside who were, you know, audibly chuckling at the just absolute madness of what they're witnessing. But for God's sakes, this is Memphis wrestling. You should know that it comes with the territory, to coin a phrase. I really hope that wasn't Dave Brown's car. But he, as I said, he's probably got full glass coverage. I mean, he probably makes a decent salary, supplemented by doing the Memphis wrestling on the weekends, along with his meteorologist work. So Lawler, just to make it clear, he doesn't get run over here. This is just a good old-fashioned parking lot fight that ends with Eddie Gilbert just sort of disappearing.
Lawler picking himself out of that windshield. Jumps Gilbert from behind. That's the parking lot you're looking at. Jerry Lawler and Eddie Gilbert. That's Lawler right there. I don't know where Gilbert took off, I guess. As Eddie has disappeared, Lawler going back looking for him. That's not Eddie right there. Good night. He slammed Lawler right into that windshield on that car. Whew. Boy, oh boy, oh boy. What a ball.
Eddie Gilbert is not long for Memphis at this point, because within a month, he's going to become the booker in Continental for much of the balance of 1988. Not all the way to the end of the year, because remember, he shows up in the NWA towards the end of the year in the U.S. title tournament, where he's in the final in Clash 4 with Ron Simmons against the Fantastics. Very, very long match with a lot of selling by Eddie Gilbert. So he's more than just this great talker and big angle guy. He could also sell his ass off in the ring as well. But this is pretty much the end of him for this run. Yeah, a couple more matches with Lawler on the way out. As I said, Lawler is going to win the AWA title off Curt Hennig on May the 9th at the Mid-South Coliseum. But how do you follow a parking lot brawl like that? Because there's still a decent amount of time on the program. You probably need something of a palate cleanser in between. And there's no palate cleanser quite like the trivia contest, the Renegade Rampage trivia thing that they're running. Now, Renegade Rampage is something that, when I looked it up, it's some sort of weird Fortnite thing that I don't understand, and is not my area of expertise, so I'm going to stop talking about that right now. But the Renegade Rampage, you'd see it on the aprons in World Class and in Memphis. I remember seeing it on the USWA ring in that 1990 show I did earlier this year. And they had this trivia contest where you'd win a trip to something or other. It didn't really make a lot of sense to me.
For a win, a disqualification win, and so on, and 0 points for a loss. Now, all of those points will be added up. There will be a finals of it, and we're going to end up with a very large distribution of money.
Now, maybe I'm not understanding this right, but it sounds an awful lot like the Team Challenge series to me. But that has nothing to do with the trivia thing that's going on. So what's the trivia question for this week, Lance?
This is one that you will need to put the answer in, and we'll give you the address where to send it in just a moment. Name the only two brothers who have held the NWA World Heavyweight Championship or title. This is a single match. This is not tag team. We're looking, there were two brothers, only two in the history of NWA that have ever held the NWA World Heavyweight title. We want you to name the two brothers.
And the correct response, of course, is who are Dory Funk Jr. and Terry Funk. The prior week's question was Jerry Lawler had shaved. Name three people whose heads Jerry Lawler had shaved at some point. And the guy said Don Bass, Bill Dundee, and Tommy Rich. And the winner of that was Kelvin Hunt of Olney, Illinois. And I can assure you that unlike the Miss Teen or the Little Miss Tennessee or Little Miss USA, there is an uncomfortable amount of info available on Kelvin Hunt. I'm not saying, you know, you can find his social security number or anything like that, but a lot like addresses and stuff. It really kind of made me feel bad. So I'm going to just go right into the final six-man tag, which is not a very long match at all, because which is weird, because you think, well, you got to get all six guys in at some point. Oh, no, this is Memphis. They don't play by everybody else's rules. Like, on one side, you have Jeff Jarrett, Billy Travis, and Scott Steiner. So the least crazy of those three guys is probably Jeff Jarrett. And they are taking on the assassin, but no, not that assassin. This is a fake assassin, Jonathan Quinn, and the Atomic Punk. I don't know what the hell is up with that name. But yeah, this ain't going to last long. So you get a double backdrop by Travis and Jarrett on Jonathan Quinn. And then Scott Steiner tags himself in here in his Memphis debut. He picks Quinn up and hits the Davy Boy Smith British Bulldog style running power slam. And that is how he picks up the 1-2-3. So two guys on the other team don't even get into the match. Talk about an easy payday. Hey, just go out there and stand on the apron and like pretend like you want to break up the pin. But nice little power slam by Scott Steiner. I can't say that they give him a lot of shine in his debut, but he does hit the finishing move and does pick up the pin. But yeah, I always talk about the enhancement tag teams. If they're allowed one tag, two tags, it's the level of respect that they're given. They weren't even allowed a single tag because we don't have any time for this. Because we got Jerry Lawler coming back to the studio. Now he's regained his bearings after that parking lot brawl. You know, getting slammed through a windshield can be pretty traumatic. I mean, he didn't go through, but, you know, it did break under him. Lawler, at this point, he's got a full beard. So, you know, respect for that. Because usually he has, like, the evil goatee over the years. But now he's got a full beard. And he seems to be reborn, kind of like me. And he's very fired up.
Let me tell you something, Eddie Gilbert. I can stand a lot more than that, Lance. I can stand anything, Gilbert, that you can dish out. Believe me, brother, you can't touch me on your best day. I promise you, Eddie Gilbert, no matter what you try from now on, you're not going to be able to put the king down. You slam me through a car windshield, you slam me through a concrete floor, and I'm going to keep coming right back, and I'm going to get right in your face until I do this, Eddie Gilbert. And I'll tell you what I'm going to let you do, brother. This week, I'm going to let you live up to your name. You call yourself hot stuff? Well, you're going to get real hot this week, Gilbert. Higher than anybody's ever been when they mess with the king. Now, let me just say one more thing. I want to make this short. I want to make it sweet. You know what I got in store for you, Eddie Gilbert. But you got that sleaze bag running around the ring with you that you call Missy Hyatt. Well, Missy Hyatt, when you get in a wrestling ring, when you get yourself near me, you're putting yourself in a man's place. And let me show you right here what happened to the last little valet. Take a look at the screen. This is what happened to the last valet that tried to interfere in my matches. Now I want to tell you something, Missy Hyatt. I hope you get close enough to me for me to get my hands on you, because I promise you, I'll do the same thing to you. Eddie Gilbert! Hot stuff, Eddie Gilbert! You're going to be real hot, brother.
A previous valet incident that he's referring to is when he piledrove Angel back in 1984 during his feud with Ravishing Rick Rude. That is best known for the fact that apparently, according to legend, when he was piledriving her, she was not wearing any underwear. So good for Jerry, I guess, on that one. I'm not sure why she would have chosen to do that. Who knows, really? I'm not going to bother to break down the videotape on that. Although, maybe I should just go back and do some 1984 Memphis as part of my commitment to do more in the future. But the king is pissed off. He's going to drive Eddie Gilbert out of Memphis. But he's not going to do it forever, because before long, Eddie Gilbert will be back there. You know, by 1990, you know, he'll take a parking lot brawl to the next level. And that'll do it for Memphis Wrestling for April 2nd, 1988. I use this show to kind of give thanks for the existence of Memphis Wrestling and how much I enjoy it. And in other podcasts, we have a similar theme this week, like on the Wrestling Podcast About Nothing with Mike Crockett and Brian Fury, as Brian Malonis is down at Disney World when they were recording, giving thanks for the wonderful world of independent wrestling. Sonny Goodspeed joins them as a guest. And, of course, Brian Fury owns Chaotic Wrestling, so he's got more than a little bit of a stake in the game. And, you know, talking about where it brought them in their lives to this point. On the Our Vantage Point podcast with Joe Marotta and Michael Quinn, they give thanks in their opening segment, I guess. It's more of an appreciation. But giving thanks to Arn Anderson is something we should do, quite frankly, more often than just sort of an annual Thanksgiving. I like to think that I do that on this program on a regular basis. And on the sportscasters, my good pal Steve Bennett, the Adams Division podcast as well. He talks to Greg Prado, who wrote a book about Soundgarden. So I guess Steve's giving thanks for the existence of Seattle-based grunge music. Certainly he's a huge Pearl Jam fan, but, you know, beyond that, Nirvana and Soundgarden. I gotta say, I like Soundgarden more than Nirvana back in the day. It feels weird to say that, but then again, Soundgarden really sort of hit it big with me after Cobain was dead already. So it's not like that was some sort of head-to-head matchup going on with the two of them. So do check all of those podcasts out. I do have one segment that I haven't been able to do for a while, in part because I haven't been able to get everything off of YouTube of late, and that is the return of YouTube Comment Theater. And as always, these are actual YouTube comments left by presumably actual YouTube users. It's a fairly well-known channel that I pulled this off of. 24,000 views as I'm looking at it, so why don't we just go right into the comments, of which there's 42 of them. I'm not going to go through the whole thing, but you know, just kind of give it a good sampling. Baba Yaga says, I almost read that as Baby Yoda, because, you know, Christ, that's been all over social media. But Baba Yaga says, gotta love how Memphis Wrestling from 1988 makes a lot more sense. It is more entertaining than TNA and Ring of Honor is right now. Peak of Memphis was 82 to 86 to boot. My opinion, not a fact. This comment is actually from 5 years ago, so that would be why they're saying TNA instead of Impact. Travis Sloan says, I love Lance Russell's comment about the Lawler-Gilbert studio brawl when he says, I'll tell you one thing, I don't condone these fights in the studios and all that, but this is one I can't cry about. It's a shame that WWE can't be as fun today as this stuff was many moons ago. Here's to yesterday. And yeah, and a lot of these comments, it's a theme. Every time I do YouTube commentator, somebody says crap on the modern product. But yes, I do like it presented more in this way. Steve Holston said, the night Lawler got to pile drive Angel, she didn't wear any panties. I paid good money to have been in Lawler's boots that night. All right, we get it. I mean, who really knows? I don't really need to see what Angel has got. I mean, it is what it is. Doc the Metal Freak says, I'm wondering how many people called the police about a brawl in that parking lot when it happened. And yeah, those things would happen occasionally, but it seemed to be brought up more in the consciousness when Lawler got hit by the car. I mean, this was relatively brief compared to that. Jessica and Ricky says, Brother Ernest is hilarious. Gonna pave the street with gold records. Okay, that was a pretty good line, although it just really got me thinking about how that would be incredibly inefficient to do it that way. Borneo Jimmy says, wow, I didn't recognize the Harris Brothers at first. Memphis was always one of the best TV shows, in my opinion. They always had at least one interesting angle or feud going on. I'd agree that the peak years were around 82 to 88. They were putting out a good product well into the 90s. Even the last few years of the territory were more fun to watch than what the big two had going on most weeks. Talking in that mid-90s period, I have a few of those episodes marked. I've always kind of held out hope that a full episode with Flex Cavana, a.k.a. The Rock, was going to show up at some point from 1996. Geodeuce says, what is behind the random appearance of Steve Kern in this episode? No interview, nothing? Well, yeah, he's just kind of there to fill time, I guess, for a minute and a half, 2 minutes. Like I said, he's a reliable guy you know is going to show up and can fill a specific role in your 1980s territory. And finally, Spoonie G says, no relation to Shorty G, I would assume, Jerry the King Lawler versus Khloe Kardashian in Jell-O match. I don't know what the hell they're getting at there, so I'll just call it right there for YouTube Comment Theater. Now, I got to do this next thing, even though I really don't want to, seeing as though I am now 18-18 on the season, and that's just pathetically bad. I mean, you could flip a coin and have the same level of success picking football games as me, but hell, why don't I just do it? Vinny Vegas Corner. Like I said, 18-18 on the season, 1-2 last week, where I had to do the picks online because I had recorded the show before there were any lines for the Week 12 games. But now we got the Thanksgiving holiday, and I'm going to just do the three games that are on Thanksgiving Day, just to kind of keep it simple for this week. So I was going to do two of them anyway, and I'll start with the third that I wasn't going to do, the Detroit Lions, of course, hosting the Chicago Bears. Everybody wonders, why do the Lions always host a game on Thanksgiving? And part of that, why they and Dallas host every year, is because they actually volunteered for it back in the day when teams did not want to have the home game on Thanksgiving. So that's kind of something that they've been grandfathered in. Lions hosting the Bears. Lions always play that first game in the afternoon because the Cowboys would be starting at 11:30 otherwise, but the Cowboys are always a more compelling team. Bears are favored by 4.5 right now, in part because the Lions are going with a new quarterback. Yeah, apparently Jeff Driscoll has not been cutting it for them, but they haven't struck me as a truly inept, pathetic team. And this is the one time a year where all eyes are on the Detroit Lions. So why the hell not? I'm going to go ahead and pick the Detroit Lions getting 4.5 points because I do not trust Mitchell Trubisky giving 4.5 points on the road on a short week. I don't care what the Bears' defense is at this point. I don't know what the hell happened to them since last year. That double doink did more as much damage to the Chicago Bears as it did to Kona Crush back in 1993. So we get the Dallas Cowboys hosting the Buffalo Bills. Cowboys favored by 7 points in that one. And the Bills, I haven't been entirely impressed with them. For DVOA from Football Outsiders, they're ranked in the mid-20s for teams, even when they had a 7-3 record. They dominated Denver last week, which I know, no great shakes there, but they're now middle of the pack in the league. They're 8-3 coming into this week. And a lot of people have them penciled in for that fifth playoff spot, that first wild card, the AFC. What you need to do is you need to look at that Buffalo schedule coming up. And I'm sure that they can kind of peek at it and see what's coming. After that Dallas game, they host Baltimore, and then they're at Pittsburgh, and then at New England on Saturday. None of those games are easy. In fact, they're going to be underdogs in each of the including this one, each of the next four games before a home game against the Jets to close out the season. So they may look at this game as, holy crap, Dallas is probably the easiest opponent out of all. I guess Pittsburgh, but Pittsburgh's got an extremely strong defense. So they're getting 7 points here. And while I'm not crazy about the Bills' offense, I'm going to say that they're going to at least hang in there in this one. So I will take the 7 points in the Buffalo Bills against the Dallas Cowboys. And then finally, this one's actually rather easy. The Thursday night game, New Orleans and Atlanta. Once again, this one is in Atlanta at Mercedes-Benz Stadium. A couple weeks ago, the Falcons upset the Saints in the Superdome in one of the most bizarre results in the NFL this season. And the Falcons won the next week. And then last week, they kind of reverted back to form by losing pretty badly to the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. The Saints are going to need this game. They want to get a bye in the NFC playoffs. They want to have that home game in the divisional round. And with the way that they lost to the Falcons the last time, I feel like they're going to come out loaded for bear in this one. I know I'm doing this with great trepidation because those NFC South games are often very, very weird. We have like New Orleans, Tampa. The way those four teams all interact with each other, it's wild, it's unpredictable, but they do make for some of the best games on the NFL schedule. But probably not this one because I could see New Orleans winning this one like 34-17 or something like that, easily clearing 7-point spread. So three picks. Detroit plus 4.5 with the unknown quarterback. Buffalo plus 7 and New Orleans minus 7 on Vinny Vegas Corner. Now, as for next week's show, I'm going to go back to the NWA, and it's not quite Jim Crockett Promotions because this is going to be right around the time that it was sold to Turner in November of 1988. It'll be November 19th, 1988, NWA Pro, which will have the world title tag team title match between the Road Warriors and the Midnight Express in New Orleans, which is not a match that I had seen before when I had watched it down in Florida about a week ago. And we're also going to see Rick Steiner, the whole lead up to Starrcade 88, including a video tribute to somebody who is not even active in the promotion, which was a little bit bizarre, I will say. And also, I got to get Jim Cornette's reaction to the tag team title loss to the Road Warriors. So that should be interesting as well. Now, in the meantime, between now and then, if you could be a dear and leave a 5-star review for Greetings from Allentown on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, whatever they are calling it, it is very helpful. You know why? Because it provides what is known as social proof that you're listening to and enjoying this podcast. I don't know why I just decided to go into a Jim Ross voice and reading, whatever. It doesn't really matter. I mean, I should just wrap this damn thing up. I've been doing a lot of podcasting lately for somebody who didn't do any for a week. So the show is at about that mark where I'd like to end it off. Right between 133 and 135. That's kind of the sweet spot. So without any further ado, that'll do it for this week. Thank you so much again. And tune in next Thursday for another exciting episode of Greetings from Allentown.
Can you imagine Eddie Marlin naked? Ew!